From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Filipino Americans have been in LA since the beginning of the 20th century. The first wave established communities called Little Manilas in the areas we now know as Little Tokyo and Westlake. Later on, immigrants spread out as far as West Covina and Panorama City. So Filipino food is nothing new, but there's been a recent surge of interest in Filipino foodways, and with it, a new generation that's proudly representing their culinary heritage. It's an exciting movement, and this week, we're listening in. Let's begin with a Filipino food crawl of Northeast LA. Our starting point is Eagle Rock, where Filipinos have been living for more than 50 years. Right now, we're at the Eagle Rock Plaza. It's a shopping mall with a handful of Filipino businesses, including a Seafood City grocery store and a few restaurants. Joining me are some folks who are well acquainted with the food we're eating.
Chase Valencia, I'm the co-owner, general manager of LASA.
Karen Thompson, I'm a professor at USC.
I'm Nastasia Johnson, co-founder of LA's first Filipino food truck, The Manila Machine.
I'm Paula Mardo, host and producer of Long Distance, a narrative podcast about life in the Filipino diaspora.
Our group is at Jollibee, a Filipino fast food chain with more than 1,200 restaurants worldwide, including Times Square.
Okay, so I'm here with the Filipino Food Fan Club. Tell us what we should order.
So because we're at Jollibee, there are certain things you should get. The first is obviously the Jolly Spaghetti. It's spaghetti, but it's slightly sweeter. You have to get the Chicken Joy. It's just this perfectly crispy, crunchy chicken. You got to get the Peach Mango Pie. And I'm told you have to get the palabok, which is like a noodle dish. There's some fans over here of it. And you got to get the pineapple drink.
Perfect. Why not? Let's go get some joy.
Is there an order we should do this in so as not to destroy our palates?
Definitely not. It's salt on salt. We have two combos with Chicken Joy and two different noodle side dishes. One is the Spaghetti Joy, which is a kind of sweet spaghetti with chopped up hot dogs. It's your perfect post-World War II, what's left over from the military taste bomb. And then you've got palabok, which is a rice noodle with shrimp and a bunch of lovely ground meats and crispy chicharron sprinkled on top.
What are in all these little side things?
The gravy. What I like to do is get the chicken, break it up, put it on my rice and gravy, and just mix it up. And all of a sudden, it's a chicken rice gravy plate.
What are some fond memories?
Well, I didn't grow up in the Philippines, and I grew up in LA, but my first experience was eating my aunt's version at home, and I was raised by my four great aunts, so I had many titas around me, and they made me spaghetti with hot dogs at first, and I was like, what is this? Because we had Vienna sausages all around all the time, and then they took me, so then it became like your quick weeknight meal, Jollibee or McDonald's, and always a pie at either, so.
When I was a kid in Manila, I remember loving the Yum Burger so much, or whatever they call the burger at the Jollibee there. Here, I eat the Chicken Joy, I have the palabok, I eat the things that are more on that savory end of the spectrum.
Okay, so I have to ask you about the Joy. Is it called Joy in the Philippines, or is Joy a translation?
So I grew up in the Philippines. So they would have all these ads of children biting into Chicken Joys and smiling, and it is called Chicken Joy there because it brings you joy. I remember after school, we'd go to the mall. There'd be a McDonald's on one side, a Jollibee on the other, and we'd always go to McDonald's because it was like the cool American thing, and Jollibee was just always there. But when I moved here, Jollibee became this like nostalgic place, and that's why I like to eat it now. They both kind of have a special place in my heart, but I think now as an adult, as a Filipino American, Jollibee is even more special to me.
Chase, tell us what we're about to eat.
We're gonna have the peach mango pie. It's akin to the baked apple pie from McDonald's, but I'd say a Filipino version.
And it looks like it's fried.
I think it is. It is fried. It's kind of sweet. And then inside you get a peach mango tastiness.
When he bit into it, he got really happy.
It's just like that old school McDonald's pie that you grew up on in like 80s and 90s. It's that crunch. This one is like the Filipino version of it.
That's quite good. I wish I didn't know about that now.
We'll get back to the food crawl later on in the show, but first, let's hear from two people who are on a mission to inform others about Filipino flavors.
I think Filipinos are really excited, too, to be seen and to share their culture, not behind their homes or in the outskirts, but in these kind of forms.
Nicole Ponseca and Chef Miguel Trinidad are the partners behind Maharlika and Jeepney, two restaurants that are awakening the palates of New Yorkers to the depths of Filipino cuisine. They're also making a bold statement with their recent book, the title of which is, I Am a Filipino and This Is How We Cook. I want to start with Nicole. How did your previous career in advertising push you in the direction of food and help you recognize the lack and power of representation?
Wow, out of the gates. That's thank you for that question. When I was first here in New York City and working at Saatchi, I was part of creative briefs. I was reviewing media edits on commercials, and the repetition of who was selected to be in the commercials, the casting calls, or the review of the creative briefs of demographics and psychographics, it was abundantly clear I didn't have any representation in that discussion. And it became clear who was important for advertisers or who mattered. And although I was like 21, 22, I was putting these things together and then also coming of age. So for me, I was always wondering what I could do, how I could contribute, have a career, make a difference, any of those. So became obvious for me that being Filipino and trying to do something, if no one else was changing the conversation or attempting it, maybe I could. But I didn't grow up thinking I wanted to run a restaurant or own one. But at that time, food was the lowest hanging fruit. I thought that I could help shape conversation or get people interested in my culture and making it a universal conversation.
You grew up in San Diego, correct?
Yes, I did. I grew up in a small town, Rancho Bernardo.
And there's a fairly large Filipino presence there.
Oh, it's huge. I mean, neighboring towns were Mira Mesa, Peñasquitos, National City, and I went to college in San Francisco, and it would be a big debate which one had a bigger Filipino community, National City, Chula Vista, or Daly City. So I grew up very comfortable in my culture, identity, seeing people that look like me on the regular.
And then you decided when sort of the bloom of advertising wore off and you felt that you had to take this on, you made a decision to stay in New York, and you were very focused about the kind of restaurant that you wanted to have.
Yes, I didn't leave advertising right away, though, because, of course, it afforded me stability, health insurance, and I could keep my parents at bay with their concern. For 12 years, I moonlighted. So in the daytime, I didn't stay at Saatchi that whole time, but I was in advertising and production for more than a decade, and I made it to VP of business development. But at night, I had started as a dishwasher and a host, you know, segued into serving and bartending whenever I could.
And you met Miguel in one of these restaurants in which you were moonlighting.
Yes. I was at a place called Lola, and I was working, and he caught me in the doldrums of figuring out how was I going to move the dream forward, because at this point, no one was going to invest in me. At that time, I had zero experience. Filipino food, no one knew, cared. It was not even on anyone's radar. And I would knock on chefs' doors. So you have to imagine, social media wasn't around. I would scour newspapers, like the Village Voice, like physical newspapers. And if I saw Filipino chef in Montclair, I would hop on the bus and go and knock on the door and say, hey, I have a dream. You know, would you be interested? Always, no, I'm not interested. Or no one would pay prices for Filipino food. No one's interested. Okay, fine. So here I am. I'm at a banquette in a corner. I am doing a Tita Oprah ugly cry. And Miguel's like, yo, why are you crying? You know, it's heaving almost. Like, I can't find anyone to help me. And he was like, okay, relax. Maybe I can help you. And then I looked up and then I was like, well, you're not even Filipino. And he was like, well, all right. So let's get past that. I'm Latino. And I was like, oh, okay. And, you know, for 2 years, Miguel and I would practice on Saturdays in Williamsburg in my small little apartment, testing out recipes before we even really introduced it to anyone. We were rehearsing in our garage band.
Miguel, when you first stepped up, had you already eaten a lot of Filipino food, or was it for you just trying to figure out this completely new landscape and make sense of it for yourself in terms of developing a palate and then developing the culinary chops?
Well, when we met, I was like most people. I had had lumpia and maybe one Filipino dish. I didn't know too much about it. Diving into it, I learned a lot of similarities between Filipino food and, you know, my Latin background. There's a lot of influence from Spain, so there was a lot of dishes that were comparable to each other, with the exception of, you know, substituting a couple of ingredients. Like arroz caldo has ginger and garlic. In Dominican Republic, we do an arroz caldo, but it's done with tomato and garlic.
What do you call it in DR?
Asopao.
Or salt would be substituted with patis.
Correct. Fish,
right.
So there was a lot of similarities in the food, but I didn't know too much about Filipino food until I met Nicole.
What's so interesting to me about Filipino food is because it's a food developed over these waves of colonization and trade influence, it's sort of like this fascinating interstitial place where what you and Miguel just described is happening constantly in all the dishes. And at one point in the book, you describe yourself as a Latina Asian, which mm-hmm. is really interesting. I've never heard a Filipina say that. But as a shorthand for making people understand in sort of big swaths what the influences are, I think that's really smart.
Thank you. There's a scholarly book out there, The Latinos of Asia. So it's borrowed from that. But it does encompass, I think, something that I could not have put into words growing up. And if I could say Latino Asian American, I would. But the food itself, yes, definitely Latino Asian. And it's woven in our culture, in our the nuances, in our language. I mean, I had never heard of chavacano until I went to the Philippines in one of the last trips for the research, and deep into Mindanao and Zamboanga. And Miguel, it was so odd. We were rolling in a car and the radio was on, and in that kind of like staticky radio, right? And he heard Spanish, but it was chavacano, and he said he could understand everything. We're so Latino, we're so Asian, they're inexplicably connected forever and ever.
So we're having this conversation. I'm in Los Angeles, a city forever tied to Mexico. Can you talk about how the Spanish and Mexican influences in Filipino play out from an historical standpoint, but also in particular in the Robinson's tamales?
So we were colonized by Spain, and when they came through to the Philippines, they came through a viceroy city through Mexico and Acapulco, and here we have the Spanish galleon trade. And growing up, we always hear, oh, we're very Spanish or mestizo, and oh, even Miguel right now referenced the culinary influences that are so rampant from Spain. But I reckon that more so than specifically Spain, how much more of Mexico we have in our blood, in our food, in our way of being. You could even, you know, see it in our facial features. Sometimes I will look at people from Mexico and I see so many more similarities. And I don't think that we were rubbing elbows with the Spaniards or the aristocracy, and to a certain extent, the friars and the Catholic Church, who the Filipino people were likely rubbing elbows were with Mexicans who were aboard these ships on the trade boats. And you see the regionality from ports. You see, obviously, what I just said, too, about Chavacano and the languages. I was doing research, and some have argued the woman who introduced mole was either Chinese or Indian. But when we even dig deeper, one could argue, was she Filipino? But they did not have the word for Filipino. So you see the ties of mole deep in Filipino cuisine in Mindanao and Pueblan dress. There's so many different connections. It's like a mystery that is beginning to unfold that I never knew until I researched and traveled.
When it comes to the Robinson's tamale, there you see the influence of Mexico and the Caribbean. You know, a tamale in the Caribbean would be known as a pastel. The Robinson tamale in itself is made from rice flour and coconut milk, as opposed to in Mexico, where it's done with lard and corn. You get the influence of, you know, the Chinese influence from the peanuts that are added to the masa for the Robinson's tamale. And there's so much influence. It's just like a melting pot of different cultures in that tamale. It's super delicious.
You know, the other influence of that isn't necessarily Mexican, it's American. Robinson was a sailor who married a local girl in Cavite, which is my dad's hometown, which is where that recipe's from. And that specific kind of tamale is named after the husband and wife. And it's so interesting, in San Diego, when we did our book signing, a gentleman came up to me and Miguel and was a little bit in tears and very much in shock. And he said, I had no idea. How did you find this recipe? You really did research. I'm Robinson. I am the grandson, or the great-grandson, rather. So it's everything keeps coming full circle. Yeah.
That's just extraordinary. So I want to focus on a few different recipes. Out here, we're pretty familiar with lumpia, pancit, adobo, lechon, the big sort of standards of Filipino food that I think are maybe first bites of people who are coming to it from outside the community.
Primarily Luzonian. The interpretation of those specific recipes as a category, mainly from the mainland in the Philippines, Luzon, which probably represents the mass migration of people who were able to come to America, were from Luzon.
Some of the recipes are just extraordinary and not really complicated to make and so interesting. The eggplant omelet.
The torta talong is a very simple dish. You know, when putting these recipes together, we wanted to make sure that they were easy to follow. And what the eggplant omelet is a smoked eggplant that you char over the embers of a flame or on top of your stove. You peel off that skin so you have that charred smoky flavor. And it's simple because you keep the eggplant whole, you mash it up, you dip it in some egg, and then fry it up. And the remainder egg, whatever's left over from the egg that's beaten, you just pour it over and let that soak into the eggplant itself. And it gives you a light, crispy skin. I mean, my mouth is watering just talking
too.
About
this. It's so simple, so good. And then with a little of the fish sauce.
Instead of using straight salt, batis, which is fish sauce, a byproduct from the fermentation of shrimp or fish, was used as salt. It rounds everything out. It gives it that funk, that umaminess that people aren't familiar with.
So give me a dish that isn't super, super complex for people to make, in which using this product will blow their minds in terms of transformation.
Arroz caldo. Yeah. The Chinese call it congee. Dominicans call it asopao, but it's a rice stew. Soup.
It's a rice soup. Miguel, you know, taught me a lot about food and the use of salt and acid. So adding lemon brightens it up. But when you add patis, you take that basic rice soup and it sings. And it's more than salt. It's like its flavor. It opens up ocean. It's such a simple addition. The ingredients, rice, what else, Migs?
Ginger,
garlic. Okay.
Chicken stock.
And then adding lemon and patis just to finish it, not to cook with it. So that can't get any more simple and also very budget friendly. And I'll show you an example of how using patis can make something very American, or in Miguel's example, Latino, and adding patis makes it Filipino. And that is just taking a beef stew. Just take, even if you have nothing else, a cupboard of just a beef stew in a can, adding patis suddenly reckons it to caldereta. And that's, these are the little nuances of being Filipino.
I've been speaking with Nicole Ponseca and Miguel Trinidad. They're the partners behind Maharlika and Jeepney in New York City, and their book is called I Am a Filipino and This Is How We Cook. After a short break, it's back to our Filipino food crawl. Don't go anywhere.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this week we're looking at Filipino food. Now we head to the next stop of our Filipino food crawl in Northeast LA. Our gang makes the 5-minute drive to Toto's Lechon Manok for some savory, meaty snacks.
We've gone to the godhead of pork. We're at Toto's.
So when you walk into Toto's barbecue, the first thing that greets you is a Santo Niño. So it's a figure of, you know, the Christ as child. And it's like the symbol of Catholicism in the Philippines and also colonialism and all that stuff. But the fact that it's right here, I mean, you don't see this in a lot of restaurants, but I think that's fascinating. And it's right next to some very Filipino condiments. You'll see the Jufran banana ketchup, which we might have over some of our food today. And of course, you have to have the nor. Sometimes you have Maggi, but nor is like a liquid, salty, umami seasoning that you put over rice, maybe with a little butter or something.
Hi, can I order the lechon belly? We're also going to order some, the roast chicken, and also the barbecue, pork and chicken, one of each. Some rice. How many scoops? 4 scoops. And
are we gonna get any dillies?
Dillies. We'll get some dillies, some rice and some vinegar. A set right there. I like it with my breakfast. A little fish on the rice. A little texture crunch. And I think that's it. Chase.
Chase?
Chase.
C-H-A-S-E,
yeah.
Right?
One of the things we're going to be eating is lechon manok, which is a roasted chicken dish. I know that the word lechon is usually associated with pig, with a big whole pig, roasted pork with that beautiful cracked brown skin. Lechon manok is a variant on that, and it's from the Visayas. There's a particular area called Bacolod, which is between Panay Island and Cebu, where there's just a whole Manokan road where you can get this roasted chicken, roasted over coals. The marinade for lechon manok is soy with some sort of sweet element and citrus. The secret to that sweet element in most places, including the ones back in the Philippines, is 7-Up or Sprite or lemon lime soda. So I'm interested in seeing what this one's going to be like.
Try the chicken.
Wow. Better than Zangkou. That's my comment. Why is it better? It's perfectly succulent. It's not undercooked. It's not dry. It's filled with delicious, yummy aromatics like onion, lemongrass, leek. Yeah, garlic. So good.
Toto's is really good. It's legit. Tastes fresh, well seasoned.
And then we have some gorgeous lechon pork belly stuffed with chilies and lemongrass and other aromatics.
This is crispy, porky goodness. The pork inside is just like perfectly cooked, nice and yielding, but not dry. I may be moving my allegiance away from porchetta. Sorry, Italy.
This is really good, the lechon. Just because you really taste the flavors of like the spices, and it's not dried out, and crispy skin. I mean, if it's not crispy, it's not lechon.
So it's time to give our little tummies a rest. Later on in the show, we'll resume our Filipino food crawl. But right now, I want to explore a genre of Filipino cuisine that includes some of the dishes we just ate.
Filipinos love to eat.
We love to drink, but we also just love to hang out and share stories.
Born and raised in L.A., Marvin Gapultos is an authority on Filipino food and drinks. For years, his popular blog called Burnt Lumpia has championed the unique and vibrant flavors of the Philippines to an American audience.
In the Philippines, Bulutan is as much about camaraderie and socializing than it is about the food.
Marvin's newest book is dedicated to a special category of Filipino food that pairs well with spirits. The book is called Pulutan, and it's about the drinking, food, and bar snacks of the Philippines. Hi, Marvin.
Hey, Evan.
So many people know you from the Manila Machine.
Yes.
That wonderful Filipino food on wheels that you chucked all over L.A. for a while.
It was a good time.
And then it went away.
And then it went away. It was a great learning experience, a great life experience. It helped me introduce Filipino food to those who may not have had a chance to try Filipino food or even, you know, have any idea of what it was. And that was good. But it was also a great learning experience just knowing that I'm not made for the restaurant business. So it was good.
So let's talk a pulutan. What does that word mean?
It literally translates to pick up with the fingers. So generally, it refers to Filipino finger foods, appetizers, and things that go great with an alcoholic beverage.
So you talk about this kind of food as a pre-colonial food tradition in Filipino culture.
Yes. In my research, I found that in the earliest Spanish text written about the Philippines, they found that the Filipino chiefs and the indigenous Filipinos were already drinking, you know, their native wines, rice wines, and different liquors made from coconut sap and things like that, and eating things like turtle eggs and different birds and fowls. And they specifically noted that it wasn't part of like lunch or dinner. It was definitely like an in-between thing. And that was the first recorded instance of pulutan.
Well, I love that.
Yeah.
And what was your first experience with it?
I guess drinking. I was in the Philippines a few years ago, and I always knew it was a thing. Like I said, it was always a thing with my family, but I never put it together as an adult drinking with my family. So when I was there a few years ago, my cousins took me out to different bars and we were drinking. And it's funny, like it's like not even a thing. It's not something, let's go out and have pulutan. It's just something that happens and you drink and you have bar snacks and you hang out. So
how different are the bar snacks to things that you would eat at other times during the day? Give me some examples.
Well, it's a very thin line. I mean, the thing is you don't have to drink with pulutan, but that's kind of what the differentiator is between like an appetizer and not. So you could have lumpia as an appetizer, but you could also have lumpia as pulutan, just wash it down with a beer. And generally speaking, in more olden times, like there would be more like offal, crazy eating, like the balut, and there's different stews of like goat innards. And I actually have a recipe called papaitan, which is a stew of beef and tripe and bile. And those kinds of foods also that kind of show off your macho side if you're with a bunch of men, you know, traditionally, and just to show what if you could out-eat each other and then out-drink each other.
So there's one section of the book called Pika Pika.
Yes.
What does that mean?
That is also means just a pickup. It's another word for pulutan. I used it to differentiate just smaller bites, things that you pick up, you know, as opposed to different sections where there's bigger dishes like stews and things. Pika Pika, it could be as basic as peanuts, bar peanuts, and in the Philippines it's called mani. And that could be interpreted in so many different ways. And there's a lot actually in the different LA restaurants, there's different versions of mani. But mine is just salt and vinegar peanuts. There's also quail eggs, which is called kwek kwek. And in the Philippines, it's traditionally just an orange batter that's made orange with annatto. But I did a corn dog batter, so it's kind of corn dog quail eggs, which I thought was fun.
How fun.
Yeah.
I love that.
I wanted to make the book fun and accessible for different people, so.
There's a recipe in the book that's a grilled cheese sandwich made with queso de bola, mm-hmm. otherwise known as Edam. Queso de bola meaning?
Ball of cheese.
Ball of cheese.
Yes.
The best name ever.
Yes.
And, for cheese.
And it's usually a Christmas time cheese. You'll see round globes of that red wax cheese on tables during Christmas time, but I mean, it's Edam cheese. You can find it anywhere. But if you want to find, like, also queso de bola in the Philippines, it tends to be saltier.
Oh, I wonder if that's a preservation thing.
It probably is. I put that in a grilled cheese with bagoong and
which is
fermented shrimp paste. lots packed with umami. So
wow. Okay. So fermented shrimp paste is something you can buy.
Yes, at any Asian market.
And are you slathering it on, or are you just adding?
I would say it to your taste. I use a couple teaspoons just so you know it's there. I wouldn't call it a slathering, but you could definitely go that way.
God, that's so great. And it's so different. I mean, usually when you hear additions to grilled cheese sandwiches, mm-hmm. they're things that tend to be sweet, like caramelized onions. Mm-hmm.
And there is some mango jam in there, too, just to offset the saltiness of both. So there is that balance in there.
So the umami and then the sweetness, this sweet and acid, like you say with the mango jam, and the shrimp paste, I feel like that kind of captures the essence and what some might say is the genius of Filipino cooking.
Yeah. I mean, there's just so many flavors and a lot of balance and a lot of umami. Sourness is also a hallmark of Filipino dishes, also with you know, citrus juices like calamansi lime and vinegars that we use a lot. So yeah, Filipino food, it's tough because people always say, how would you describe Filipino food? And a lot of people say it's sour, and it is, but it's so much more complex and varied than just the sour notes.
Sour and funky.
Yes, sour, funky, and everything else, yes.
Yeah, so what's really interesting to me is in the sort of this modern moment of mm-hmm. Filipino food, is how the different chefs are playing with the sour and the funk and making it accessible.
Yeah, it's like a gateway drug to Filipino food. And that's the genius with guys like the Valencias at Lasa or Charles Alali at Mom's Stir. They know what they're doing. The flavors are all still there. It's still very Filipino, but they have a very deft touch with it.
Yeah, that's a good word. So let's talk about acidic. There's a section in the book on raw and barely cooked. Mm-hmm. Could you give me an example?
Kinilaw, which is a Filipino dish of raw fish. People like to compare it to ceviche, but we don't actually cure it in the acid. It's more closer to a Japanese sashimi that's just quickly dipped in calamansi juice or vinegar. That is also an indigenous Filipino thing. It's not in any way connected to Spanish ceviche, which is why people, you know, people think there's that connection, but it's always been there, and that's always been one of our dishes.
Which makes total sense because you have all those calamansi trees and a ton of seafood.
Yes, exactly.
I love that. I also really love vinegar, and I love how vinegar is not a condiment in Filipino food. I mean, it's so beyond that.
Right. And it's used as a preservative and in our adobos. Adobo, which is, you know, something braised in vinegar and soy sauce or salt. You know the vinegar's there, but it's not a sour vinegar. The long cooking time of an adobo really mellows out that vinegar flavor. So we use it in different ways to preserve and we achieve different flavors with it, either as a sauce, as a condiment, because we always have it at the table to dip in, but also as something to cook in.
Early on in the book, you offer some instruction about calamansi limes, which are featured prominently. Mm-hmm. Could you describe the flavor, how it's different from other limes or lemons?
Calamansi limes are small, about the size of a gumball, found throughout Southeast Asia. They are sour like a lime, but they have this incredible orange aroma, like a mandarin orange aroma, and it just smells fantastic. Oh, it's a weird cross between an orange and a lime, but more sour than sweet.
Very aromatic.
Yes, very aromatic.
And are they easy to find now here?
I live out in the Inland Empire, and there's a mom and pop Filipino store near me. They always have calamansi, and someone was asking me if you could find it at 99 Ranch, and I have, or at Seafood City, and I have seen it at some, but not at all. So it is still a bit of a difficult thing to find calamansi. The best way is to know somebody with a tree. Lots of Filipinos have calamansi trees in their backyard, and my mom has one in her backyard, and that's another source.
That's awesome. So grilling, skewered grilled meats mm-hmm. are pretty well known.
Yes.
Talk to me a bit about what you love to serve. Like if you are having friends coming over and you're doing your own pulutan.
I like to make a mix of, you know, different things like seafood and pork. There has to be pork. I'm Filipino. So there's a grilled pork recipe that is pork belly. And traditionally, it's made with a 7-Up glaze. And 7-Up and soda, it's big in the Philippines, just as a marinade or as a glaze for grilled meats. But I use a ginger beer for my grilled pork belly, as well as a little molasses, just to get a little bit of sticky on there. I also like to serve the kinilaw that we talked about earlier.
Okay, why pork? You said you have to have some pork.
Pork? Well, pork because it's fatty and rich. Pork is great with beer. My book has a lot of beer pairings in it that I suggest, you know, different kinds of beers beyond Filipino San Miguel. And pork is great with beer because you have the richness and fattiness of the pork, and that gets cut with, you know, what depending on the beer, the carbonation and the bitterness of the beer. So it's a great combination.
So for those new to cooking Filipino food, mm-hmm. who look at Palutan and say, I want to take on this project, what sort of ingredients should they start with? Like, what's the minimum pantry?
Well, I would say vinegars. Starting off with apple cider vinegar is fine, but you could also find different types of Filipino vinegars, cane vinegars, coconut vinegars at the Asian market, and even at some supermarkets. And also fish sauce, a really good fish sauce would be good. And if you can't find calamansi limes, lemons and regular limes work well in a pinch.
So we have this flowering of Filipino food here. Uh-huh. Lasa, Mamsur, Urania. But it's been here for a really long time. Uh-huh. Where do you like to eat?
Like I said, I live in the Empire, but I was here a couple weeks ago and I was at Lasa. I love their food. And I actually go to Urania quite a bit for lunch. They don't have lunch anymore, but they're still serving dinner. So I go to Urania, and I went to Mamsur opening night. I go to lots of different mom and pop spots. Bahay Kubo. And there's a place called Manila Jeepney out in the Inland Empire. There's a Green Hill supermarket that's the supermarket that I go to. And they have a great point, like steam table portion in their store. I go shopping on Sundays with my kids sometimes, and we'll have Filipino breakfast there. And it's the coolest thing. And it's just this small mom and pop store with, you know, steam trays of Filipino food. And
I love point.
Yeah, Turo Turo. It's the best.
Well, thank you so much, Marvin.
Thank you, Evan. Thank you for having me again.
I've been talking to Marvin Gapultos. He's the author of Palutan, Filipino Bar Bites, Appetizers, and Street Eats. If you're new to Filipino cooking, be sure and check out his previous book, The Adobo Road Cookbook. It's a great place to begin. After a break, we're exploring how Filipino food has been exported around the world. Stay with us. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleinman. The Philippines has one of the largest diaspora populations in the world, with more than 10% of the population having lived or worked abroad.
I searched far and wide to gather who I endearingly call as the Avengers.
Jacqueline Chia Lowry is a UK-based writer who was born and raised in the Philippines. She decided to connect with 30 fellow expats around the world to see how Filipino dishes have been transplanted to kitchens as far as New Orleans and Toronto. She collected those stories and recipes in a book called The New Filipino Kitchen. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi, Evan.
So the great writer, John Birdsall, wrote a preface for you, and he talks about Filipino food as dynamic and fluid as molten lava, morphing to both fit and transform landscapes far from the Philippines. That is such an intriguing description, because when we think about foods from places that are far away from our own cultures, we tend to think of them as static, as, you know, a collection of dishes that never changes.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk to me a bit about the mobility of Filipinos, the uniqueness of how the life is lived in terms of so many people leaving those 7,000 islands, has had an impact on what Filipino food is around the world?
Well, I'd like to say that John Birdsall, I think he really captured what we were going after. So I think it's difficult to go to any country in the world and not find a Filipino in that place. Like, for example, I lived in kind of not very well-known places, for example, like Croatia, a city called Rijeka, but still I found Filipinos there, same like in Stavanger, Norway, for example. About 10% of the country's population have moved outside the archipelago. So as we move to different environments, to different countries, we miss the food that we grew up eating. And in most places where I've lived, for example, and it's very difficult to find some of the ingredients. So we tend to recreate the tastes, the flavors that we miss using ingredients that we find in our new homes or environment. From the beginning, the cuisine is what most people call a fusion cuisine. It's so one of the oldest fusion cuisines in the world because indigenous people have already their own cooking, and then foreign colonizers and travelers and immigrants to the country have also influenced the cuisine. So it is always evolving.
What were and continue to be some of the biggest influences part of that fusion?
First of all is the Southeast Asian nations, the neighboring countries like Malaysia and Indonesia. And then the Chinese migrants and traders that came to the country. And then the colonizers, Spanish colonizers, American colonizers. People have also moved to different countries, and so it has sort of adapted to different environments.
Can you just give us a sense of the variety of the food within the archipelago? I would imagine that if you take a dish, whatever dish it is, like sisig, for example, and you talk about different places, different islands, that it's probably made in different ways there.
So adobo, for example, is a cooking technique, a way of marinating and cooking with vinegar. The very original form of it is white. The native people used mainly vinegar, salt, and garlic. And then the influence of the Chinese came into play. And so soya sauce was incorporated. And now the more classic adobo is usually with soya sauce, aside from vinegar and garlic and pepper. From the different places of the country, for example, you'll find so many different versions of adobo. One would be a red version wherein it takes the color of annatto seeds, or what we call achuete. In different parts of the country, like, for example, again, in a region called Bicol, where they use a lot of coconut, coconut milk is incorporated with adobo, and it could also be a little bit spicier than the other versions from the other parts of the country.
Could you tell us, share with us some of the stories from some of the people that you interviewed?
The voices in the book are very varied. So we come from all different backgrounds, from first to third generation immigrants, from a chef who was born in the slums of Manila. This is Chef Christina Quackenbush. She later on opened the first Filipino restaurant in New Orleans. Her recipe is about chinilaw. She remembered growing up in the slums, her grandmother not wanting her to migrate with her mother to the United States. And she remembered in their shack not having any refrigerator. So a dish that her mother often prepared is chinilaw, because the vinegar preserved the fish and made it last longer.
So did Christina start cooking in restaurants young, or is it something she came to later?
She actually did it later on. So when she moved to the U.S., she forgot about the Filipino food that her mother used to prepare when she was little. She saw her mother eating chinilaw. She was a little bit disgusted, because she kind of believed to eat something raw is like a precursor for illness. And then later on, as she was growing up, she realized that vinegar is actually liquid heat. So later on, this dish became one of the star dishes in the restaurant that she opened in New Orleans.
You know, one of the most interesting things to me about your book is that you didn't just speak with chefs for this project. Why was it so important for you to include a cross-section of stories and experiences of those born in the Philippines, and as well as those whose families immigrated earlier and were born in the States?
Because Filipino food is complex and diverse. I thought 5 or even 10 authors, or just picking just chefs or just home cooks or just people from one place, wouldn't really encompass the diversity, the complexity, and the breadth and depth of the cuisine. I searched far and wide to gather who I endearingly call as the Avengers. I tried to include as many people from many different backgrounds as possible, coming from many different places.
How did you find them?
I didn't know any of them before I started the project. I just searched the internet and tried to look for everyone and invited them to contribute.
So unusual and quite lovely. I don't think we can finish this conversation without talking about Christetta Comerford.
Actually, the idea of inviting Chris Comerford came from my sister, who works at the Philippine Embassy. She's agri-attaché of the Philippines in the U.S. and the Americas. So she has collaborated with Chef Chris Comerford before. Chris Comerford, for people to know, is a seamstress daughter who eventually became the first female and the first person of minority background to hold the position of White House executive chef.
And what was the dish that she gave you?
She contributed the recipe for escabeche. Escabeche inspired fried snapper. Escabeche is a little bit like a sweet and sour sauce. The same day that we've emailed her and asked her, she replied right away. I think this is one of the joys of working on this book. Most of the people, they were so enthusiastic and eager to help out. I think we all share a love of the food, and we all share this desire to make the food more recognized worldwide and to promote understanding of it.
That's Jacqueline Chiolari. Her compilation of stories and recipes from around the globe is The New Filipino Kitchen. Now for an example of such a kitchen. Many of you will recall that the late Jonathan Gold was a champion of Filipino food and the people who make it. In 2017, he visited Irania, a Filipino restaurant in Santa Ana specializing in what you might call Pinoy California food. So let's start by talking about the anchovies.
The first time I went there, I sort of wandered in the late afternoon, and it was completely empty except for a table of sort of older Filipino guys who were eating plain toasted anchovies. They're really tiny. They're really pungent. It comes with a sort of chili vinegar you can dip it in. And they were drinking beer, and it just seemed like an idyllic way to spend the afternoon eating these dillis.
Yeah. So did you follow their lead?
I did.
And then I guess you also get to contemplate what's coming next.
You do. They have peanuts that are roasted in a shell with chili and vinegar and sea salt and something sweet. You know, opening them also becomes a contemplative act. They have a really good version of sinigang, which is, you know, the famous Filipino soup of pork broth that's been soured a little with tamarind. And often there'll be all kinds of innards in it, but this time there's only just a little bit of bok choy.
Are the ingredients farmer's market sourced?
They're definitely farmer's market sourced. The chef, Ryan Garlitos, worked with Carlos Salgado at Taco Maria for a long time. And so there are a lot of traditional recipes that are brought up a little bit by using, you know, super good farmers market produce.
So what were some of your favorite small plates?
They do a nice version of the vegetable dish called kare kare. Kare kare is usually a dish of oxtail stewed with peanuts. And here they do it with charred chunks of cauliflower where you'd expect the meat. It's delicious. The pancit, which is usually sort of a generic bowl of noodles, although man, is it good at Lhasa up in Chinatown. They're chewy and they're house-made noodles that they garnish sort of minimally with citrus and snips of fried chicken skin. And it comes out looking like a plate of Italian pasta, but the sour, savory flavor is very, very Filipino.
They add a soft-boiled egg to it?
There's always a soft-boiled egg. I always forget about that.
But to me, that's like a Filipino carbonara.
It is like a Filipino carbonara. And the version that the Valencias do up at Lhasa, I actually describe as a Filipino carbonara. And his is a little less carbonara-ish than that one, but it's still definitely in that family.
That was the late Jonathan Gold talking to me in 2017 about the Filipino restaurant Irania in Santa Ana. In a moment, we close out our Filipino food crawl of Northeast LA. Find out where we're going next after the break. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleinman. Let's close out our Filipino food crawl. I'm with a few friends at a strip mall just off Eagle Rock Boulevard, and we're about to visit a common style of Filipino restaurant called a Turo Turo. Here's Paola Mardo.
We are at Lutong Bahay in Eagle Rock, and we are about to hop in line to order food at the Turo Turo section of this place. So part of it is basically a grocery store where you get typical grocery products, but a lot of Filipino products as well, a lot of canned food and desserts and things. But this on this side where we're at right now, it's the steam table or Turo Turo slash Point Point place. I want to get a closer look to see what they have, but a lot of options.
Usual Turo Turo spots, there's like what, maybe like 10 options.
This is a lot. This is pretty big.
They got the grills going.
I mean, everything here is big. The woks are huge. I mean, I just doused it with vinegar. What is he making? And lutong bahay means home cooked. Luto is cooked, bahay is bahay, so lutong bahay.
I mean, one thing about Turo Turo, the Filipino dishes are a lot of stews. They have sisig, they have, grilled bangus, caldereta. I think that's sampalaya with egg and shrimp, adobo, pork barbecue, oh, vegetables, eggplant, pancit, and kare-kare.
And the kare-kare is something which is an oxtail stew made with peanut sauce. People usually use peanut butter when they're here in the States to make it. Doesn't come with a lot of salt in the stew, so you eat it with a shrimp paste called bagoong.
52!
52, that's me. Can we get the kare-kare, a medium size? So we'll also do the sinigang. So sinigang you can do with different meats. You can do it with fish. It's like, you know, bok choy, okra, eggplant, tomato. But you gotta get the pork. Porky goodness.
Sinigang is my favorite Filipino dish just because of the sour, brothy-ness of it. Like, it's soul-warming, tangy, and it's uniquely like a Filipino distinct taste.
What do you guys use for your sinigang? What's the sour? Tamarind? Okay. I love that stuff. Thank you. And the last thing is we'll just get the pinakbet. Medium. I don't know what the translation is. I just think it means pinakbet, and it's a vegetable dish. You got string beans, tomato, there should be bitter melon in there, eggplant.
The wonderful thing about pinakbet is that it's already made with bagoong, that shrimp paste, and kind of stewed in coconut milk with that. But then you kind of layer that extra little punch of saltiness with the additional shrimp paste, and you smear that all over the rice. It's just a perfect bite. If vegetarians or pescatarians are looking for an entree to Filipino cuisine, this is a good one.
And if you want that.
If you're in the mood for something sweet, a few doors down from Lutong Bahay is Auntie D's, a bakery serving a wide variety of sweets and savories. As the person behind the dessert blog, Let Me Eat Cake, Nastasia Johnson is the sweet tooth of our group.
We're at Auntie D's Panda Manila, and hopefully we're going to find some really awesome pandesal. Oh, it smells so good. Pandesal is a Filipino roll. We eat it all the time, breakfast, with dinner, you can make sandwiches. I want to see if they sell fresh baked pandesal, because it's best when you get it in a brown paper bag. You can get it already baked and in a plastic bag, which is its second iteration after the brown paper bag, but you can't beat that hot, fresh out of the oven taste. And a bag per person. No sharing. It's that good. Oh, it is warm. It's warm.
Ooh, it smells so good. I'm distributing these fluffy buns that are the size of hamburger buns, but they're pandesal, and they just smell incredible. They smell sweet and, what's in there? Is it coconut milk?
I think there's just a touch of sugar. I also do always love that there's like the crumbly top. It's pandesal on pandesal.
It's probably day-old pandesal that's made into crumbs. Knowing the frugality of bakers. But I can just imagine this like split and then toasted on a griddle with some butter and then poured over like some more butter.
The thing that people do with pandesal is they dunk it in a
cup of coffee with a lot of milk in it and sugar. So as a kid, that was my first taste of pandesal.
With
was
coffee?
Like with coffee. It was just like getting a pandesal and just like dunking it in, soaking it in, just like.
And that must be like that really fun kind of dunking where you have to really be skilled to not lose it in the cup.
Yes.
Yeah, I actually grew up eating it with butter. Butter was a thing. But you can have it for breakfast or like an afternoon snack. In the afternoon, we would eat it with a little bit of corned beef, like kind of like a sandwich, toasted.
Yeah, like all the different sandwiches we've made, like the pandesal egg with leftover adobo or leftover asado, leftovers, it just ends up becoming a delicious lunch.
My aunts used to cut it in half, then put Kraft singles and put it in the broiler, and that was my afternoon snack. So good.
Oh, yeah, cheese
Or cheese whiz with a pandesal, yeah. too. That was...
Hey, this is going to be a stretch. Have you ever had pandesal with butter and sugar?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That's what we did, too. Totally. Or sweetened condensed milk.
See, I was going to say that, but I thought that would be too, you know, I don't know, over the top.
No, we did it like that. When we cut it in half, butter, sugar, and then you, like, babysit it in the oven just to get that perfect sugary crust on top. Beautiful.
Exactly. But without the cinnamon.
Without cinnamon.
Yeah.
I can just eat a whole bag full.
There's two right here.
I mean,
many thanks to these friends for taking me along on their food crawl. They are Karen Tongson, Nastasia Johnson, Paola Mardo, and Chase Valencia. To learn more about these restaurants and to see what we ate, visit the Good Food website. There's an article by Abby Swanson, who produced our food crawl segment. That's kcrw.com/goodfood. Thanks for listening to our Filipino food show. If you missed any of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or on Stitcher. And as always, leave us a review if you like the show. My thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Abby Swanson for producing our Filipino food crawl. Thanks to Chris Ho and Kenny Ang for their help. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more good food.